For this session, I'd like to. We'll have our first breakout groups and discussion sessions. But just before we do that, I had one slide left in that initial series of slides about talking about modernist Buddhism. So I thought I might as well just talk about this one first, just to finish off that, and to talk about how modernist Buddhism affected in Mahayana as well, because it wasn't just Theravada that was affected, all forms of Buddhism have been affected. And one of the first very major influences of modernist Buddhism in the Mahayana Buddhist areas was the creation of a sort of an official sort of canon. The Chinese, the notion of a Tripitaka in Chinese and Tibetan Buddhism is somewhat different to the notion of Tripitaka in the Pali Buddhism. In Pali Buddhism, the text or the canon is very fixed and it's very consistent across all the different areas, whereas in the Chinese and Tibetan traditions, it tended to be much more fluid. And so the canonical collections included both early suttas, later texts, and then a sort of growing collection of commentaries and books and things like that. And it was somewhat loosely affiliated group of Buddhist texts, much bigger than the Pali canon. The Pali tradition has always been sort of more concerned with sort of keeping these things separate, whereas in the Tibetan and Chinese traditions they're a bit more mixed up. So if you go around to different places in China and so on, you'll tend to find the collections are, you know, pretty much similar, but they do have differences everywhere you go. And the tradition of having catalogues of the Chinese canon is almost as old as the Chinese canon itself. It's like 1,500 years ago the first catalogues were written. So in the modern era, just as in the Pali tradition, the Pali texts were edited and published in a printed edition. The same thing happened with the Chinese texts, and the Taisho Tripitaka was created. This was done at the Taisho University in Japan. And I was based on the Korean edition of the Chinese canon, which is preserved in wooden blocks in Korea. And when they edited and put that together, the Japanese scholars, had actually traveled to Germany, where they had studied under Max Müller. Max Müller, one of the greatest of the early European Indologists, and the founder of that tradition in Germany. Max Müller being someone not only a student of Buddhism, but also had translated and edited and published many of the Vedic texts as well. So they had been to study with Max Müller and learnt about the modern Western techniques of text comparative studies and text critical apparatus. They published the Taisho Tripitaka as a series in the 1920s, and if you look at the Taisho Tripitaka, it uses many of the conventions of Western books, like say footnotes, variant readings. Okay, it even has parallels with the Pali canon, so that in the suttas and the Chinese texts, it'll actually say, you know, a little footnote and say this is parallel to such and such a sutta in the Pali canon. In addition to that, but the changes in the Chinese canon were even more radical than that, because they actually completely changed the organization of the Chinese canon to reflect the organization of the Pali canon. Right? So if you look at the Taisho Tripitaka today, the first volume in the Taisho Tripitaka is the Dīrghāgama, which is parallel to the Pali Dīgha Nikaya. Second volume, Majjhima Agama, related to the Majjhima Nikaya, then the Saṅyukta Agama, related to the Saṅyutta Nikaya, and the Kottara Agama, related to the Anguttara Nikaya. So that was all organized to fit the sequence of the Pali texts. So as I said before, the Chinese canon was previously somewhat loosely organized, so in different places these things would be, you know, put together in different ways. So they weren't like introducing new texts, but they were arranging the texts that they had so that there was a more clear set of parallels between their texts and what was found in the Pali. And of course that project is ongoing, and that's what we're still doing working on Sutta Central, is to integrate these texts, because ultimately what matters is the meaning. Right? What matters is the Dhamma. It doesn't matter what language it's expressed in, whether it's in Pali or Chinese or whatever. This is just an incidental detail. Okay? The important thing is what's the meaning. So really what we're trying to do with Sutta Central is to try to take language away. Right? You know, it doesn't matter what the language is. Right? What matters is what's the meaning. So, in fact, Japanese Buddhist studies has apparently, they've apparently published more material in Buddhist studies than the rest of the world put together. Okay? So, and most of their research is completely unknown in the West, right? Japanese Buddhist studies is almost like a world unto itself. And a lot of the things they do is much more advanced and technical than anything that's available in the English-speaking world. As well as the academic side, the reforms in modernist Buddhism was also reflected in the popular forms that Mahayana took. And again, just can give one example here. There are many examples. We could mention, say, Master Shenyen, Master Xinyun, and others. But here I'll just talk about Master Yinchun. And he was one of the best-known monks, the most influential monks in modern Taiwanese Buddhism. He recently passed away. And, well, not so recently now, nearly 10 years ago. And he had spent his lifetime studying and researching the Buddhist texts and always had a rational and very sort of common sense and moderate approach to all of these things. And as time went on in his later years, he became more and more influenced by the early Buddhist texts and the Agama texts, and like the unanimity of all of the Western scholars who've studied it, he agreed that it was obvious that the Mahayana sutras were a later development compared to the early Buddhist texts. But he also argued that the Mahayana scriptures were, the early Mahayana texts were they were teaching the same doctrine. There weren't any major changes in the doctrine or teaching compared to early Buddhism. So he advocated the idea that the early Mahayana was essentially like a rephrasing or a representing of the same Dhamma which we find in early Buddhism. He was very influential in developing the idea of engaged Buddhism. In the West, engaged Buddhism became known through Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, who, by the way, has now gone to hospital. So if you're not aware of that, Thich Nhat Hanh is extremely ill and went to hospital just a day or two ago. So we should be dedicating our merit for him at the offering today. Yeah. So Thich Nhat Hanh went to Taiwan, where he studied with Master Yinchun, and that's where he got the idea of engaged Buddhism. Have a look at this is with Yinchun with Master Shenyan from Suqi, one of his most famous of his students. And of course, look at the robes they're wearing, right? It's the same color as these robes, right? Again, it's not a coincidence. The Chinese, traditionally, they didn't wear robes that color. That was done as a modern reform because they wanted their practice of Buddhism to be more similar to what they perceived as being the authentic early tradition in Theravada, okay? And so there was this kind of somewhat controversial modern reform. And Yinchun was kind of involved with that whole kind of process and discussions about should we change our robe color and all of these kinds of things. One of the things I think which is important to bear in mind is that there's no such thing, there's no kind of living tradition which is identical with what we find in early Buddhism, okay? And nor should there be. I mean, we're not living in India 2,500 years ago, right? We can't just do everything just the same way as they did then. That's not the point. The point is to understand, and that we have a place by which we can assess and reflect on and criticize what we're doing in Buddhism today so that we can do Buddhism today better. That's what studying early Buddhism is not about, being nostalgic and trying to invent some idea of what early Buddhism is about. That's a kind of fundamentalism, and that always ends up going wrong. Okay, but it's about, we're practicing modern Buddhism. Actually, I'm very interested in future Buddhism. Right, if I was to give another course, that would be what I'd be talking about. Right, future Buddhism in the future. Right, we're going to live in the future. We're not going to live in the past. Right. So it's not about trying to just live in some imaginary past, but it's about having some basis by which we can keep recreating Buddhism as a living tradition. And so what I've been trying to show through these examples is that that's what our traditions are, okay? It's not that we're the first people to invent this idea. All of the traditions that we see around us have come out of this process of the questioning and reforms and changes and so on that have gone down through history. And every time that these are done, they get frozen. And every reform that people make needs to be re-reformed again and again and again. One of my good friends in Bodhinyana Monastery is a monk called Venerable Upasama. And he's a very, very interesting character. And among others of the interesting things he did, he was one of the first generation of Western monks who ordained with Suzuki Roshi in the San Francisco Zen Center in the 1960s, right? Long time ago. And he has a lot of very fascinating stories about what it was like in Western Buddhism in those days. He later disrobed and he went and he taught Chinese calligraphy in Taiwan for many years and all of these other things. But one of the stories that he told me was what happened when Suzuki Roshi died. Now, he had, as a Zen monk in those days, he'd been very close to his teacher. And one of the things they used to do was do their gardening every morning. Okay, so they'd go out and they'd look after the Zen garden, right? And that was one of Suzuki Roshi's kind of practices. They'd go out and they'd just do a little bit of gardening, and it was their morning bit of exercise and bit of meditation that they'd do. And after he died, they had the funeral, and he went out to keep on, to look after the garden, right? That's what he did every morning. And the other people in the center said, what are you doing? He said, I'm just doing the gardening. They said, but that's Roshi's garden. You can't touch it. Yeah? That's how fast it is, okay, for a tradition to get frozen. It's no longer a living garden, yeah? It's frozen. It's become a fossil. One day, that's all it took, yeah? So all of these reforms and things that we're talking about, we need to keep on doing them every time. To me, when I look at Buddhist tradition, if I think, how do we preserve the Buddhist tradition? I don't think I preserve the Buddhist tradition by holding on and keeping things fixed and doing them exactly the same as I imagine somebody did them in the past, okay? I think I preserve the Buddhist tradition by preserving that spark of vitality and life, which is what made that Buddhist tradition meaningful in the past. Okay? It's up to us to be able to say, how do we approach our tradition and bring life to it? Right? That's how you preserve a tradition, not by fixing it, right? But by revitalizing it, by questioning it, right? By asking, by not by coming to the same answers that people in the past did, but by asking the same questions, right? And so those questions essentially is, how is Buddhism meaningful for us here and now? Yeah? And so our practice of early Buddhism should be informing that. And we've seen with those reformers in modernist Buddhism that all of those asked those similar kinds of questions, and they all came to different answers, right? Modernist Buddhism in Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka and Taiwan and Korea and Tibet and India and China and Vietnam and Cambodia and all of those countries is different, right? They never came, they didn't do exactly the same thing. But there were similar patterns that we can see, and some of those patterns include that questioning, that appreciation and respect for tradition, but the need to practice that tradition in a way which is relevant in a modern context, okay? And especially with the application of reason to the tradition, to be able to meaningfully distinguish what is useful, what is not useful, what is essential, what is inessential, what is authentic, what is inauthentic, and to try to preserve what's really important about the Dhamma. So, for the next little while, hour or so, we're going to have a discussion, and we are going to... Oops, here we are. Oops-a-daisy. I went too far there. Presentation. Okay, so here's the first discussion topic. So what we're going to do is going to break up into groups, and we're going to discuss these topics and find the answers, because there's one and only one right answer to each of these questions. Okay, and you'll be tested afterwards to see whether you've got the right one. No, only kidding. Okay, so how many groups do you think we can have profitably in this room? What do you reckon? One over there, one there, one there, one there, and maybe one here. Does that sound about right? Five groups. 90 people, so 100 people, five groups is 20 each. That's a bit too many, isn't it? What about, okay, so one there, one there, one there, one there, that's four, five, six, seven. That's probably better, yeah? So seven groups, okay? Seven or eight groups, okay? We'll split up into seven or eight groups. And you have to go to the other side of the room. Don't sit with your friends and stuff. Sit with people that are your new friends. Okay, and when you form the groups, I'll move around from the groups and join in to each of the groups. But when you first start them, please introduce yourselves to everyone in case you don't know each other. Okay. Let's go till we have to lunch at 12:15, so we'll go to about 12 o'clock. So 1 hour. Okay. All right. Okay. Go. Well. Okay, now if I was to do a text-critical study of the notion that you have to eat before noon, okay, I would notice that the ruling for the monks and nuns actually came in a number of different stages, and originally the Buddha prohibited eating at night time, didn't prohibit eating in the afternoon, but only at night. Why? Because the monk went for alms round with a skull for an alms bowl. And he went outside someone's house waiting, and there was a flash of lightning. And this woman saw this strange monk with an arm with a skull in his hand and screamed, "Whoa, the demons are coming, the demons are coming." So the Buddha said, best if you don't go at night time. And actually, when the eight precepts are described, it basically always says refraining from eating at night. Right? So if I was to be a real scoundrel and scallywag, I might even argue that originally you were allowed to eat in the afternoon. That would be so... No, but I'm not going to do that, so I'm better go and have some food before. Okay, so anyway, so I'm glad you all, everyone seemed to enjoy their first discussion session. And I've managed to participate in a few of the groups and to hear some of the things people were saying, and it's very interesting to learn from everybody. And remember that, you know, you're not just here to learn from me, but we can all learn from each other. And through discussing and articulating our views and our ideas is an absolutely essential part of our practice. So don't think of that as being sort of a distraction from the teaching. That's just as important as the teaching is learning how to talk about Dhamma with among ourselves, among our peers. You know, in a week or so, I'm going to be gone. You're not going to be able to come and pester me with your questions anymore. But your friends are going to be here, so you can pester them all day long. Okay, very good. So, you know, learn to become that refuge for each other. Okay, so we'll have the dhanana, and we'll be back here, I think, what time are we supposed to start? 1:30. So 1:30 we'll all see you back here.